It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Findlay, Ohio. Adam Zirker is co-founder, chief executive officer, and chief investment officer of Hixson Zirker Capital Management. As chief investment officer, he oversees investment research and the development and implementation of the firm's investment strategies. Adam serves as a co-portfolio manager and as chairman of the firm's investment committee. Adam has experience providing investment management and financial advisory services since 1999. Prior to co-founding Hixson Zirker Capital Management in 2002, Adam worked at a CPA firm for 3 years, specializing in financial planning and investment advisory services for high net worth individuals. And now, on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome back to you, Adam. Please go ahead.
John, thank you for your kind introduction, and thank you for inviting me to present at the Best Ideas Conference. It's an honor to participate alongside so many other great investors. I've been participating in these events over the past, and I've enjoyed learning so much from others that now I'm excited to hopefully reciprocate by paying it forward with a good idea of my own. So before I get started with my idea, I first wanted to share a little bit of information about our firm, what we do, and our team. So I co-founded the firm in 2002 with Tony Hixson. And we're an RIA firm specializing in investment management and in the large cap U.S. equity space. And we're located in Findlay, Ohio, as you mentioned. We currently have $135 million of assets under management and with over $60 million allocated to the strategies that I mentioned, the focused equity portfolio, the focused equity income portfolio. Both of those are large cap U.S. strategies, and where we apply our discipline of investing in high quality, durable, and growing companies that are trading at value prices. Those portfolios have roughly 30 stocks each in them, and so we are concentrating in our best ideas. And today, I'm going to present to you one of the ideas that happens to be in both portfolios. So our firm is, or our strategies are managed by a team of four, and I lead that team, and we have three others on the team, including Tony Hixson, Josh Robb, and our research analyst, Austin Wilson. My experience goes back to 1999. As you mentioned, I began at a CPA firm where we then launched an investment advisory business at that firm. I was there for 3 years before founding my own firm. I'm a graduate of the University of Toledo. So today I'm excited to present to you what I believe is one of my best ideas for 2019. The company is one that probably everybody on the call has some experience with. If you have children, or if you like to watch movies, or if you're a sports fan, surely you have been touched by Walt Disney Company. And so Disney was founded in 1923 and trades on the New York Stock Exchange, and is currently trading for about $112 a share with a market cap of $167 billion and led by CEO Bob Iger. The company's headquartered in Burbank, California, and has over 200,000 employees worldwide. So this is the company I've chosen to present because of one very important catalyst that I'll share with you in a minute that I think is going to help Disney sort of go out of or trade, have the potential to trade to the upside. As you look here, we began investing in Disney in August of 2015, so just over 3 years ago. And our experience so far has been, you know, not quite exceptional. It's been sideways. We've made a bit of money counting dividends. You know, we have a return of more than 3% per year, but it hasn't quite broken out like we thought it would. But now there's a catalyst that we see coming at the end of 2019 that we think will prime the company for future growth. I'll talk about that in a minute. So Disney has four segments or four areas of business that they report in their financials and SEC filings, but we've added an additional segment because we think it's going to be an important focus for the company. And that additional segment is their streaming service. And this happens to be the catalyst that we think will help Disney trade higher in the future. So I'm going to dig into each segment, but first I want to show you the revenue by segment. So the chart on the left shows you that Disney's media networks contribute 41% of overall revenue. Their parks and resorts 34%, their studio entertainment 17%, and consumer products 8%. And then by far the largest portion of the revenue comes from the United States, followed by Europe, and then the Asia Pacific. It is believed that China will be the largest theme park region in the future, so we do expect that the percentage of revenue attributable to the U.S. and Canada will probably reduce in the future, while the Asia Pacific region will actually be growing in the future. So the first segment, the Disney, their largest segment is the media network segment, and that represents 41% of overall revenue. Disney owns ABC fully, and they own large portions of A&E, Lifetime, and the History Channel. They happen to own 50% of those channels. They own 80% of ESPN. So they share ownership with those entities with the Hearst Corporation. But as I mentioned, if you're a sports fan, you're probably familiar with ESPN for sure. And then you have the Disney Television Group and ABC, which also you are likely to have been a user of. The second business segment is parks and resorts. So if you've never been to a theme park, it is or a Disney theme park, it's certainly something you should experience at least once in your lifetime. They go all out to try to give you a great experience, and they do a great job. And from my own experience, it seems like there's nothing they haven't thought of. So everything is well organized, and it's just designed to give you and your family a great experience. So 34% of their revenue comes from these parks. They own locations in Florida, California, as well as Paris, and then other smaller locations around the U.S. Or properties. They also own a cruise line, and they own 47% of a park in Hong Kong. The remaining 53% is owned by the government, and then 43% of a park in Shanghai. And then they have a park in Tokyo where they don't own the actual park, but they receive royalties from licensing. So theme parks make up about a third of the revenue and have great potential going forward, which I'll talk about in a moment. Studio entertainment is also a significant portion of the revenue, 17% of their revenue. And most likely you have experienced one of these brands through some sort of movie or so forth. So Disney owns Marvel, they own Frozen, Star Wars, Pixar, Avatar, and it's important to know that they have a lot of great new movies coming out. So actually Avatar is coming with their acquisition of 21st Century Fox. But some new movies to look out for over the next year are the new Star Wars movie, The Last Avengers, Frozen 2 is coming out next year, which will be a big hit, and then Toy Story 4. So this is a segment that also presents a lot of opportunity going forward and with a lot of big releases coming out in the near future. Along with the movies would be the television area of the studio entertainment. So as I mentioned earlier, they own ABC, so you can see a lot of the different shows and such that you see on ABC that you may have seen, and then the Disney Channel. So if you have kids, you probably have seen the Disney Channel before in your lifetime, but this is all another piece of a very well-diversified business. And then finally, we have the consumer products and interactive media. That makes up 8% of their revenue. So think toys, you know, any toys that they make or licensed to toy makers, and they receive royalties from toy manufacturers. That's 8% of revenue. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we think a big catalyst for the business going forward is going to be the streaming services. So Disney recently announced, and there were rumors they were working on a streaming service to compete with Netflix. So when you think of streaming services, the biggest catalyst we think is going to be something called Disney Plus. So Disney Plus is going to be a subscription service where you will pay a monthly fee to subscribe to all Disney content. So think in terms of, you know, everything you see on the Disney Channel, all of their movies and television series. This service will not, as far as we know, include ESPN Plus. That is a separate streaming service that you pay a fee for, and that's currently in existence. For $5 a month, you can subscribe to ESPN Plus and get all ESPN content, including live sports games and also original content. Disney, they're expecting to launch Disney Plus in the fourth quarter of 2019. And we'll talk in a moment towards the end of the presentation on what we think the potential is for Disney Plus as far as subscribers and revenue opportunity goes. But another important piece of their streaming service is Hulu. So Disney happens to own currently a 30% stake in Hulu, with another 30% coming when they complete the acquisition of 21st Century Fox. So the remaining 40% of Hulu is owned by Comcast, who owns 30%, and Time Warner, who owns 10%. And Bob Iger has indicated that he would love to buy the remaining 40% of Hulu if presented the opportunity. I mentioned ESPN Plus earlier. That was launched in 2017. So that's a newer streaming service, and it's an area that's going to grow. But the lower right there, BAMTech Media, this is a company that Disney acquired in 2017 to help with streaming technology operations. And this team at BAMTech is the team in charge of basically developing the platform for Disney Plus. So they've been hard at work, and they will be through the end of this year. And it seems to me that they're putting a lot of effort into making this a successful launch. You know, they're taking their time. They're not rushing it. You know, they have about a year to build this out. And it's going to be a direct competitor to Netflix. So I think it's important that they've acquired the skills and the people to build that out properly. So I mentioned that they are in the process of acquiring 21st Century Fox, but in addition to 21st Century Fox, they've been growing well, both organically and inorganically, as they've had many notable acquisitions over the last 25 years. Some of the key purchases have been BAMTech, as I mentioned, in 2017, Lucasfilms in 2012, Hulu in 2009, Marvel in 2009, Pixar in 2006, and ABC ESPN in 1995. So in the last 25 years alone, Disney has spent over $100 billion in acquisitions. So with the 21st Century Fox acquisition, this deal is going to be a $71 billion investment. And it's going to be in equal parts cash and stock, so approximately $35, $36 billion of cash, and they will issue 343 million shares of stock. 99% of Disney shareholders voted to approve this deal just this past July, and the deal is expected to fully close in early 2019. So let's talk about some of the underlying economic trends that we think are going to provide a tailwind to Disney. The biggest being the growth in video streaming. So the global video streaming market is set to grow from about $31 billion in 2015 to over $123 billion by 2024. That's a compound annual growth rate of 17%. This rapidly growing market can be contributed to a number of factors. So the first of being the rise of online users around the world, advances in technology. So as technology evolves, you can stream high quality content with high resolution without disruption, and the cost to stream that content has come way down. Also, just the development of content. So content makers, media companies have really put a lot of emphasis in developing high quality content, and the quality just keeps getting better and better. So people are interested, and the increase in subscriptions for streaming options, it seems like the world is heading towards a subscription-based economy. So, just like with software, where we've went from licenses to subscriptions, our media is being consumed through a subscription model. Rather than purchasing a DVD or renting one, you just subscribe to some sort of entertainment option, whether it be cable or some sort of standalone service like Netflix or maybe Disney Plus. Consumers, they are using more and more of these streaming services because you can use them on so many different devices as well. So advances in modern smartphones, better internet connectivity, really present an opportunity for growth in this market. So another economic trend that Disney will benefit from is just the growth in theme parks. So in 2017 alone, if you look at the top 10 theme park companies around the world, there was total attendance of over 475 million people. And that attendance last year was up almost 9% from where it was a year earlier. So that is great growth in theme park attendance. And also of interest is China's growth. So in China, we saw attendance grow by nearly 20% year over year in 2017. And they now generate about a quarter of the major operators overall total attendance. So we think China is an area to pay attention to, and it is great that Disney has a presence in China. Also, an interesting fact is that all of this attendance is now almost 500 million visitors per year, and it's more than double the attendance of all major sports leagues in the world. So when we invest in a company, one of the key things that we review when evaluating a company is their competitive situation. We want to know, does the company have some sort of economic moat? And we have five areas of moat creation that we look at. And what we've done here is we've taken those five and looked at and evaluated Disney to see, you know, how strong is Disney's competitive advantage. And what we believe we found is that Disney really stands out in four of those five areas. So first, they have real product differentiation. You know, they've certainly differentiated. There's only one Mickey Mouse, and no other company can, you know, have the rights to a lot of the properties and brands that Disney has. So through their patents and trademarks, they've clearly differentiated their product. And that leads into their brand. So when I mentioned Disney at the beginning of this call, almost everyone probably had a perception in their mind, and I'm guessing a pretty strong reputation. When you look at not just the Disney brand, but also the ESPN brand. So when you think of sports, and if I've asked you where would you get your sports news, you know, a lot of people would probably answer ESPN. So they have a trusted brand and a strong reputation. With their new product, Disney Plus, they also have the opportunity to build a product or service at a lower price than their competitors. So they've already said that their goal with Disney Plus is to come in at a price point lower than Netflix. Now, Netflix is going to have a, you know, arguably a broader range and spectrum of content, where Disney Plus is going to be completely focused on family based content. But when we look at the market out there and the number of households with at least one child in the U.S., we think, you know, that's a pretty big market, and we think that Disney is coming in with a product that is going to be priced very competitive with Netflix and lower than Netflix. We don't exactly know the price yet. We're going to make some assumptions about that later, but we think it's a possible source of their competitive advantage. And then there is a high barrier to entry. You know, if you look at what Walt and Roy Disney sketched out in 1923 when they had the vision for Disney and founded the company, they are basically building that vision still today. And it's interesting to see how it's all come together. But it would take a new competitor a long time to build what Disney has built. So in our opinion, they have a high barrier to entry. Nearly 6,000 trademarks, over 1,700 patents already granted, and another 1,000 patent applications outstanding. Again, this is a big part of Disney's wide moat. So how do they stack up to their competition, or who are their competitors? If we look at the different business segments, we'll start at the bottom left with media networks. You know, ABC competes with, the other big three, NBC, CBS, and Fox. Their parks and resorts, by far, they have the most attendance of all parks in North America. But we have Six Flags, Cedar Fair, Universal Studios, Carnival Cruise Lines, Royal Caribbean. They're all competitors in a way. Studio entertainment, we've got Warner Brothers, Sony Pictures, Universal Studios, Paramount. And then their consumer products, well, really, these are, you know, just other toy manufacturers that they're competing with. And then finally, the streaming services, where we see the most opportunity. It's our opinion that Netflix is their biggest competitor, followed by potentially Amazon. Some of the other companies have the potential to also be a direct competitor there. But when you look at this slide, one thing that really stands out to me is that, yes, they have some competitors in different segments of their business, but no one company does everything that Disney does, and as well as Disney does. So let's talk about Disney's theme park dominance. We see that last year, in 2017, theme parks around North America had a really good year. The top 20 theme parks, they were up in attendance by 2.3%, with over 150 million visitors in 2017. Now, if we look at Disney World's Magic Kingdom alone, Magic Kingdom remains the world's most visited theme park. And in 2017, there were more than 20 million people that went to Magic Kingdom, including me and my family. And in China, while not yet the largest market, they've experienced the most growth by far, and they're projected to turn into the largest theme park market by the year 2020. So it does bode well for Disney that they've already invested in multiple locations in China. So you can have a great company, but, you know, of equal importance to the business strategy and the product is the financials. You know, how are they doing? One theme that you'll notice as we go throughout these slides, I'm going to go rather quickly because really what you see is almost everything is up and to the right. They've had steady growth, steady numbers, and steady profitability. So first is the revenue. So revenue has been growing consistently over the past 10 years, up 5% per year over the past 10 years. While operating margins stand at 25%, operating income is about $15 billion. You can see operating income has grown 7% over the past 10 years. So income, operating income is growing faster than revenue. That's a good sign that they're managing their costs well. The company's earnings have been growing. We've seen excellent growth in earnings, double-digit growth rates, which is what we like to see. Over the past 10 years, you see 12% compound annual growth in earnings. Quite a bit of a jump here over the past year. You know, the company has had a boost and or will have a boost going forward from the tax cuts. They also have benefited over the past 10 years from cost control and stock buybacks. But one notable is that if you just look throughout the history of Disney, they have a history of profitability, even in recessionary times. So it's a durable company that we believe will withstand a lot of different economic cycles and environments. Margins have also been increasing, the net margins at 19%. Cash, they've always carried a solid amount of cash on the balance sheet, currently about $4 billion of cash. Long-term debt at nearly $27 billion. This represents about a 39% debt-to-equity ratio. CapEx, they've continued to invest in the business steadily and increased their investments over the years. We see about $4.5 billion of CapEx over the past year. Free cash flow, one of our favorite metrics. We like companies who spin off tons of free cash flow, and Disney is approaching $10 billion a year of free cash flow, and they've grown that 10% a year over the past 10 years. So in our opinion, that's one of the drivers of economic value to the company and ultimately shareholder value. They've also been buying back shares. They've reduced shares outstanding by about 3% a year over the past 10 years. I would note that they'll be issuing about 343 million new shares to fund their 21st Century Fox acquisition. At the current share repurchase pace that Disney has had historically, we think Disney will be able to retire those shares or buy back those shares within the next 5 to 6 years. Dividends. We like dividends, and the company has had a solid track record of not only paying their dividend, but growing their dividend. They have a 17% compound annual growth rate in the dividend over the past 10 years. And we look for companies that are paying dividends. We like to see them increasing their dividend at least 10% a year, because then that gives us the opportunity to double our dividend income every 7 years or so. And so 17% growth in dividend is a nice track record over the past 10 years. Let's look at a couple profitability measures. Return on equity looks solid at 28%. Return on assets at 13%. Return on invested capital, one of our favorite profitability measures, is now at 18%. And they've increased that over the past decade. And we like to look at a company that has the ability to improve their economic value added. So this is the difference between return on invested capital and the weighted average cost of capital. You know, it shows to us that the company's generating higher returns on their capital than the cost to acquire it. So they've done a fine job of that here more recently. And free cash flow to sales. So free cash flow to sales is currently stands at 17%. Let's talk about company management. I've mentioned that Bob Iger is the CEO. Bob Iger is currently 66 years old. He's been the CEO since 2005. He also has held the chairman role since 2012. Prior to being CEO, he started his career with ABC back in 1974, and he rose through the ranks at the company until ABC was acquired by Disney, and then he eventually became the Disney president and COO before becoming CEO. He's been a director with the company since the year 2000. It's also important to note that he holds enough stock that we believe his goals are aligned with those of shareholders. So he holds over $100 million of Disney stock. He's also on the board of Apple, which is notable, as well as the September 11th Foundation and the Bloomberg Family Foundation. The board of directors is completely independent, with the exception of Bob Iger. We think it's especially encouraging that board directors are required to own stock 5 times their retainer, so everyone is aligned with shareholders. One of the things we like to look at with board members is how has the company done since the board member has been elected to the board. So what we've done here is we're showing you the compound annual growth rate for revenues, earnings, and free cash flow for each board member since their inception. So you can see a lot of green there, a lot of positive numbers. In our opinion, the board members have proven their value to the company. They've generated exceptional growth in all of these metrics. One thing I'll point out is that they do have a couple of board members that also are involved with other companies. So CEO of Nike, Mark Parker, Mary Barra, CEO of General Motors, and then Mike Froman, who has some political history and familiarity, and also is at MasterCard. So they have a great board that we believe is managing the company well. They are also regulating key executive compensation at a level that we think is reasonable. The top table is Bob Iger himself. The bottom table is the rest of the board. I'll just point out that over the last 5 years, average revenue for the company has been $50 billion, while key executive compensation for the last five years was $68 million. So as a percentage of revenue, we think compensation of about 0.1% seems in line with a company doing as well as Disney. So let's wrap up with a discussion on valuation. This is why we're excited about the company. Not only is it well managed, not only do they have a great product and service and a catalyst for the future, but we think it's reasonably valued, if not significantly undervalued. So just looking at traditional metrics, looking at the current PE ratio, Disney is currently trading at a PE multiple of 15.6. Over the last 5 years, they've had an average PE of 17.2. So they are currently, if you just compare Disney to its own historical PE multiple, they're currently trading at a 10% discount. When you compare Disney to their peers, and their peers here are listed at the bottom, you have 21st Century Fox, CBS, Discovery, and Viacom. Netflix is also a peer, but they're omitted from Bloomberg because Netflix, their numbers are skewed in most metrics. So if we take Netflix out and we look at Disney's historical PE, they've traded at 15.6, while their peers have traded at 12.3. That means Disney normally trades at a 26% premium to their peers. In our opinion, that premium is justified because of the diversification of their business and the many business units they have that are doing well. But if we look today, currently, they're trading at a 26% premium, historically a 25% premium, so right in line with historical averages. So now let's dig into some of our own work. We've done some modeling on Disney's valuation, and so we modeled future free cash flow, and we discounted that to today. And you can see we have a number of assumptions here. So we assume that Disney will grow revenues over the next 10 years on their standalone business of 5%. So when I say standalone business, I mean Disney as it currently stands. So this does not include what we think the potential would be for Disney Plus. I'll get to that next. So we assume gross margins stay as they are today. We have a tax rate of 21% and so forth. So if we use those assumptions and we project future cash flows and discount them today, the present value of those cash flows is at about $53.50 per share. We then assign a terminal value to Disney at year 10. Based on year 10 earnings and a PE ratio of about 19, we give it a terminal value per share of $103 per share, giving us total valuation of roughly $156.90. At $112 current price, that represents a 40% discount. So we think that current Disney as it stands, even if they did not launch Disney Plus, has 40% upside. So what we did next was we took a look at, well, what happens if we throw on this new business opportunity of Disney Plus? And there's a number of assumptions that we could make about that, but the biggest of which is, how many subscribers will Disney Plus have? What kind of growth will they experience? And what will be the monthly pricing? Since we don't know exactly what that'll look like, we've shown five different scenarios here. You know, our base case kind of being the middle range here. And if I just walk through the base case scenario, we're assuming that Disney Plus has the potential to gain 15 million subscribers. We believe that our assumptions are pretty conservative when you consider that the U.S. alone has over 50 million households with children. And so we believe a substantial portion of those households, plus households without children, will consider Disney Plus as a viable entertainment option. And then you consider the fact that Disney Plus is launching globally. We think 15 million is a reasonable number. I believe Netflix started with like 23 million users. So, you know, we also said, well, what if we're wrong? You know, what would be a bear case? We said, you know, maybe 5 million users would be a worst case scenario right out of the gate. Then we're assuming a 15% growth rate in subscribers. And we've decided to price it anywhere from $6 to $10. In our base case, it's an $8 a month pricing. We think it'll probably come in somewhere around that, maybe $7, $8 range. So with those assumptions, we then applied a PE multiple, you know, after we forecasted earnings based on a blend of the margins that we're seeing for Disney and Netflix. We gave it a PE multiple of 35 in our base case scenario. You know, it's hard to say which PE ratio we should use. Netflix trades above 50 times earnings. So we think 50 times earnings is justified for that area of the business, but also maybe a bit aggressive. So in our base case, we said 35 times earnings. It's going to be a high growing business, so probably going to justify a higher PE. So with these assumptions, we think Disney Plus alone could be worth anywhere from $2 a share to $52 a share, most likely somewhere around $16 a share. We add that to our Disney valuation, and we get a current or a valuation of anywhere from $158 a share to $209 a share. That means that Disney, as it stands today, with the potential for Disney Plus, is trading at what we believe, or has upside of, you know, is trading at a 41 to 86% discount to potential upside. So, in conclusion, we'll just show you a quick chart. Here's the one-year stock chart. You can see Disney is currently trading below its 50-day moving average, but above its 200-day moving average, and the 200-day, as well as the other ones, are rising. So even in light of the market weakness we've had the fourth quarter here of this year, Disney's held up fairly well. And we think, you know, that Disney has a very diverse business with proven segments that have stood the test of time, been around since 1923 and expanded that. They're positioned well for growth with their upcoming and continued efforts in the streaming segment. Their history of acquisitions has helped accelerate growth, will propel it into the future. And they're already benefiting from economic tailwinds and trends for streaming services and theme park growth. It's hard to deny that Disney has entrenched itself as the global entertainment leader and earned itself a wide economic moat. And while it certainly has competition, Disney does not have competition with the same diverse business model or total scale that it does. It stands out amongst all of its peers. Fundamentally, the company is growing in a very healthy way in nearly every metric, and figures that we think will only be bolstered once they complete their acquisition of 21st Century Fox, and with the completion of the Disney Plus platform, and once that's up and running. So the company's generating great returns on equity, assets, invested capital, and they are returning or adding economic value for their shareholders. Leadership, including Bob Iger and the board of directors, have proved to be a very effective team. And by our measures, the company is undervalued as it stands, but drastically undervalued when Disney Plus potential growth is also factored in. So these factors combine to make Disney our best idea of 2019 and beyond. So with that, John, I'll turn it back over to you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take those questions now.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for such a comprehensive presentation. Truly appreciate it. Can I just ask a quick question on a piece that was a component of value in the past, but it seems to have fallen off, and that's ESPN. Does Disney still own a piece of that, and is that significant at all?
Yes, Disney still owns 80% of ESPN, and we think it is significant. Yes, there are questions about the value of ESPN. When you look at ESPN currently has been part of cable platforms and cable providers, and so there were concerns that the value might be eroding as people cut their cable services. And so that was a big reason for launching ESPN Plus, where they give subscribers the option to subscribe to ESPN Plus for, I think it's $5 a month. And so we think that by adding that new option, even though a consumer may cut their cable, which is going to hurt their licensing to the cable companies, it's a new source of revenue. Plus, I would also mention ESPN is available on Hulu Plus, YouTube TV, and Sling. So they are, you know, licensing that to multiple platforms, and I think there's still a lot of value with ESPN, in my opinion, because they are certainly one of the leaders in sports coverage.
On the theme parks, from data that I've seen, it seems like they've really pushed pricing quite hard there, clearly demonstrates pricing power, but also maybe raises the concern that they've really extracted pretty much everything they could from the theme parks and the pricing side. How do you look at that? You know, what's your take on just how much prices have gone up over the last decade?
Sure. You're absolutely right. Disney seems to have, you know, again, it's another source of moat, I believe, is they've been raising prices consistently year over year, and I think it's because they can. They are the leader. So when you look at Magic Kingdom and the attendance there, I think as long as they can charge for it, they'll continue to increase pricing. And I think it's not just theme parks, but entertainment in general. You know, like I'm a college football fan, and I'm in Ohio, so Ohio State football fan, and I look at ticket prices there, and they just voted again to increase prices or their board of trustees voted, I think, to increase ticket prices for sporting events there. So I think entertainment around the world is getting more expensive. So, but I think the thing you have to remember with Disney and their theme parks is that there's nowhere else you can go to get the exact same experience. So like with my example of a football game, you can find another sports team, or you can find a different sport you like, but Disney is kind of its own thing. And so as long as visitor growth continues to increase as it has, and you add the price increases, you get a very nice top line. So I think as long as they can do it, they will. Now, one of the things we've looked at is how well do they do in recessionary times. You would think they would do, you know, not as well, but they still do get some good attendance during those times, and the company's still profitable. And I think, you know, that's when you may find growth in some of their other segments of their business. You may find that, well, instead of going to theme parks, we're going to subscribe to Disney Plus or something like that. But again, I think you also have to remember that the Disney culture and brand, they have a strong brand, and there's some people who are just absolute fanatics about Disney. And they, you know, I know people that go to Disney for every vacation. I know people that, husbands and wives, they go, even when they don't have the kids, they go to a Disney park. That's not me, you know, but I am a consumer of Disney, but not to that level. But I know they're out there. They have a very sticky culture, and it's a family activity. So I think, you know, that's attractive to a lot of people.
And Adam, if we could talk a little bit more about the Disney Plus streaming service, trying to understand what is going to be part of that on the content side. Do we know that already?
They haven't exactly told us exactly what it's going to be, you know, what the platform's going to look like and what the pricing's going to be. We know that it will definitely include Pixar, Marvel, Disney, and National Geographic content. So all of that content, all of those movies and television series, that all gets wrapped up into Disney Plus. What it won't include is the ESPN Plus. There's talk that they may bundle that together, but they haven't said that. That's just speculation among analysts. There's also, excuse me, speculation that they could really bundle even their theme park tickets. So if they wanted to, they could create some sort of a VIP package where if you pay a certain dollar amount, you get to, you know, have a pass to the theme parks. You can have Disney Plus, ESPN Plus. You can have the whole package. So basically, you can have Disney as a subscription. You know, again, that's just speculation. The company has not announced anything like that. So, you know, I think we'll get more information as we, you know, as it's developed throughout 2019 on exactly what Disney Plus will look like. But I think just if you just look at the content that they have from their studio segment, their cinema and TV content, I think, you know, it's pretty impressive alone. You know, I'm also guessing that next quarter's earnings call should provide some additional information, just like last quarter earnings. I think they just announced the name of it during the last quarter's call. So we expect each quarter we'll get more and more information. So we're a little bit early. We know that. But, you know, the market does look ahead. And I think with the downturn in the broad market, this could be a buying opportunity if you're a long-term investor.
And trying to understand what revenue may go away as a result of Disney Plus, is Disney going to not have content or as much content on Netflix or iTunes? How's that going to work? And is there, in other words, is there some kind of an offset to the incremental revenue that's coming?
Yes, that's a fantastic question and very insightful question. And you're absolutely right. They will lose some revenue. So if you think about it, right now, if you want to watch a Disney movie, you may go purchase one. So DVD sales, things like that, that will all be phased into, you know, I think most people, just like you now listen to music on streaming services. And, you know, CD sales have declined. You know, it's just the way the world has evolved. So it gets replaced. So even though there's revenue going away, it does get replaced. Now, you asked about Netflix. The answer is yes, they are going to phase out Disney content on Netflix. The agreement that they currently have is that those deals will expire. Now, it's possible that they may negotiate an agreement with Netflix, but our guess is that that will be very expensive for Netflix. So if Netflix wants Disney's content, they're really going to have to pay up for it now. And it just, you know, I think hurts Netflix from a competitive standpoint to do that. So it'll be interesting. The way we currently see it, we think that the content will phase out and will not be available on Netflix. it's also, Netflix has the Netflix originals, the Marvel series, where those series will expire, and after 2 years, they are. So Netflix has created these original series with the Marvel content, and the way the deal currently stands is that after that content expires on Netflix and it's been inactive for 2 years, Disney can then basically reboot that content on their own platform. So that all bodes pretty well for Disney in the future. There might be some growing pains and some some transitionary time, but that's what we see happening.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to articulate your thesis as well as answer my questions. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you directly with their own thoughts and questions, and we're happy to facilitate an introduction should it be desired. Truly appreciate you being part of this forum.
Well, thank you, John. I would certainly welcome any feedback that anyone has, any questions. I would love to dialogue with other investors, and feel free to get in contact with me.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Goodbye for now.
Thank you, John.